You're watching Channel 37, WHXN, New Salem.
On All Hallows Eve, the veil between light and dark is pierced once more, so we're going to talk about movies with weird virgin obsessions. It's Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. First, we'll do the Salem Chamber of Commerce's job for them as we watch Hocus Pocus. Then, I kinda wish I knew what was going on with Rockula.
Hello, and welcome to Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. Happy Halloween! I am Dan, and with me are Dave.
Hello!
Wendy.
Spoopy spoops.
And Will.
A virgin lit the candle.
I don't know. We are here to celebrate. And to that extent, we did watch a couple of movies that take place during Halloween, one more so than the other. But our first, Wendy, I'm gonna go to you because I know this is one of your favorites. What was our first movie?
Hocus Pocus.
Jump back. Twist the bones and bend the back.
Eat it, Captain Malik.
Back in 1693, the people of Salem, Massachusetts,
witches,
yes,
thought they got rid of the Sanderson sisters for good.
We shall be back.
300 years later, it's Halloween Eve, and they're back.
Uh-oh. We are home.
Are you broads a little old to be trick-or-treating?
Talking about three ancient hags versus the 20th century. How bad can it be?
Now they're digging up old friends. And running amok.
Amok.
Looking for the one thing they miss most.
You stay for supper.
I'm not hungry.
But we are.
Only one boy has the power to stop them.
Prepare to die again!
You have no powers here, you fool!
Before all Salem falls under their spell.
I'm gonna tell you!
Walt Disney Pictures presents Bette Midler.
Hello.
Sarah Jessica Parker.
Would thou dance with me?
And Kathy Najimy. Hocus Pocus.
Into the night!
They love to fly. And it shows.
Good night. Sleep tight. No screaming.
Yes, indeed. Can you tell us, for anybody out there that still somehow hasn't seen it, what is Hocus Pocus about?
Hocus Pocus. It's a 1993 live-action Disney film. It was directed by Kenneth Ortega, who gave us other Disney classics, such as The Cheetah Girls 2 and Newsies. He also was a choreographer and worked on Xanadu, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and Dirty Dancing. Hocus Pocus is a modern-day cult classic, but when it was released, it lost over $1.5 million. Hocus Pocus is set in Salem, Massachusetts, where my heart lives. So of course we start out by meeting the three Sanderson sisters, witches, Winifred, Mary, and Sarah, played by Bette Midler, Kathy Najimy, and Sarah Jessica Parker. Using a spell in their sentient spellbook, they drain the life essence of a little girl, which makes them younger and more beautiful. But this little girl that they have selected has a very loving older brother, Thackeray Binks, who tries to save her. And while he does fail, they transform him into an immortal black cat as punishment. Shortly before being arrested and being hanged for practicing witchcraft and the disappearance of young Master Binks. Right before they're hanged, Winifred casts a spell, that foretells that one day on All Hallows Eve, under the light of a full moon, a virgin will light the black flame candle and the Sanderson sisters will return. So then we skip ahead about 300 years into 1993, and we meet Max Dennison, his sister Danny, and his crush Allison in a really awkward attempt to impress her. Max and Allison and Danny visit the Sanderson sisters' home, which has been kept standing and was run as a house museum until very recently. Turns out Allison has keys, so they go there. He tries to be a cool dude, and like he doesn't believe in any of this Halloween hocus pocus. So he pulls out his cool guy Zippo lighter and lights the black flame candle. Well, as a young teen, our Max is still a virgin, and the sisters return, eventually running amok through the streets of Salem in an attempt to capture children and drain their life force, eventually threatening the lives of all the children of Salem. Will Max, Danny, and Allison defeat the Sanderson sisters? Like, you have to watch to find out, but the parents are no fucking help at all. In this movie, we get to see Doug Jones in a very early role. He's hot off his success as Mac Tonight. Gary and Penny Marshall have weirdly been cast as a husband and wife duo who are visited by their Sanderson sisters in their home. And we also visit a lot of the historical sites in Salem and neighboring Marblehead, Massachusetts. People still flock to Salem every year in October to go on tours of these buildings and these shooting locations, to attend screenings of the films. Lately, some of the actors have been coming to town to talk about films and do fan meet and greets. And there's also a couple of groups of buskers who are really, really into really good interpretation of the Sanderson sisters. Then you can take photos with all around town. I am definitely into Hocus Pocus.
And our ongoing coverage of the oeuvre of Omri Katz continues during this season. Thank you, Wendy. I appreciate that. Now, first of all, there's no possible way this is anybody's first time seeing this.
No.
No. Okay. Wendy, I know this is one of your favorites. Can you talk to me about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, so Hocus Pocus comes out in 93. It's a kid's movie. I have absolutely no interest in it, right? But somewhere along the way, I watch it, and I fall absolutely in love with this movie. Every fall, there are three movies that I watch to kind of set me up for the fall season. This is the only one where fall or Halloween specifically is really a factor. But every year, we have to watch the Hocus Pocus, The Craft, and Practical Magic. I fucking love this movie, right? This is my cozy movie. But at this point, it's everybody's cozy movie. So many people are into this movie. There's a whole cult of like normcore women out there who go so hard for Hocus Pocus. And I love that for them.
Yeah, it's definitely much more popular now than it ever was, especially like when it actually came out.
Yeah, it's hard to believe this one lost. I think it was like 1.6 maybe, like a tremendous amount of money, like millions, for it to be such a cult classic now, to be such a popular movie, to be something that is often like picked up in the indie and the repertory theaters this time of year. There's been a sequel, there's a sequel novel, a sequel film, and they're working on a third one. Like now, what are we, like 30-ish years later?
32, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Wendy. Will, can you let me know what are your thoughts about this movie?
So this came out when I was probably around like 8 or
God
so.
God damn it.
And so... yeah, I know.
Curse your youth.
Yeah. My youth, my 40-year-old youth. Anywho, so I first saw this, I would say almost definitely on video, because this came out the same day as Free Willy, so that's what I saw that weekend. I saw it, and you know, it was a fun movie. It was something that got shown a lot on, you know, just randomly on my local UHF channels, my channel 55s, my channel 36s, like during the Halloween season every year, and that's how I usually ended up watching it. So yeah, and then years later I I really started to enjoy it. And then that's, I think, around the same time that Freeform decided, hey, we're going to show this like every day during the Halloween season. Like, we're just going to show it like right after like the 700 Club. So, you know, yeah, this is our way of thumbing our nose at Jerry Falwell. But yeah, no. And it was honestly, like, I enjoy it. It is a fun film. It has become my first watch every year during the Halloween season of like watching 60 some Halloween horror movies. And yeah, it's fun. It has a huge following in the queer community. Like, literally, there's just in the second one, there's a reason why they have drag queens dressed up as Sanderson sisters, because that is a real thing, because their looks are very drag centered. They're very colorful. Like, it would have been so easy for the costume department to have said, hey, yeah, you know, they're witches, so they're all gonna wear black, they're all gonna have big steepled hats. Instead, it's like, no, we're gonna have like one of them with an obvious giant wig, we're gonna have one of them like with boobs just popping out, and then we're gonna have Kathy Najimy, who's basically a drag queen as well in how she carries herself, which is a compliment. Yeah. It's just like, it's a film I enjoy. It's a film I love watching every year. Is it perfect? No, but great. It's still
Thank
fun.
Very much, Will. Dave, how about yourself?
I haven't seen this film in a long time. I didn't see it at some point in the 90s. I can't remember if it was on television or on video or whatever, but I saw it at the time and liked it. It was fine. So coming back to it now, yeah, I think there's a lot to enjoy in this. I mean, I think the three actors playing the Sanderson sisters completely inhabit the characters they've been given. Like, you know, they properly disappear into them. Like, I very rarely watch this thinking that's Bette Midler. Like, that's Winifred Sanderson. And this is probably my favourite Sarah Jessica Parker performance in anything. I think there is some, like, there's a nice balance in this between kind of like, yeah, the childhood adventure of like stopping witches. At the same time, there is some quite kind of darker, more macabre things going on in that kind of level of kind of scaring kids. You know, you've got kids getting their life force drained, like, you know. You get as probably about as graphic a hanging as you can do in a family film, insofar that, yeah, you do get to see them, you know, their feet dangling and stuff. Yeah, there's a bit where the heroes feel like attempt to set them on fire when they lock them in a kiln. So yeah, I loved all of that stuff, and the scene where they think they found Satan is hilarious. the wonderful culture clash of just this dude who's just wearing a devil costume and these three 17th century witches who think that he's their boss is very, very funny. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, you get Ben Midler in a fun film like this, of course you're going to get in a scene. Like, why wouldn't you? And that bit's great. So yeah, pleasantly surprised by the fact that I still quite like this film after a long time and sort of having not seen it since I was a lot younger. It was nice to go back to something and actually kind of go, oh yeah, look, I get this. You know, this is good.
Yeah, I'm pretty much there with everybody else. I don't think I saw this movie until I met Wendy. So at some point, probably in the last 10 or so years, was my first time watching it. And I think my first time seeing it, my response was kind of like, was yours, Dave? Yeah, that was okay. Sure. It was fun. That was a movie that happened. But kind of as it's become a regular part of our Halloween, it's kind of the one that I look forward to more so than the other two. Because it really is quite fun. It is quite a bit darker than you would expect a Disney movie in 1990s to go. Like, the first thing we see happen in this movie is the witches straight up murder a little girl. Mm. That's how we kick that's how we kick this movie off. But it is, I mean, the witches, especially Bette Midler, actually no, all three of them are, they're clearly having a fantastic time. They are grabbing hold of that scenery and just chewing it for dear life. You know, I can absolutely understand how this kind of gained a following, especially, you know, in the camp communities, because this movie is camp as fuck. You know, the kids aren't annoying. In fact, Orthora Birch is actually quite good. You can understand how she kind of grew up to become an actual actress. I will say this. In fact, I was talking to Wendy about this the other night. I don't dislike Sarah Jessica Parker. She's just not somebody I really pay a lot of attention to. She's fine, normally. But this movie is like, oh, she's really good in this.
Yeah, so that's how I feel about her as well. It's just kind of like, you know, I don't dislike her. It's just sort of like, you know, anything that I've seen her in, generally speaking, she's just sort of there. But here, I don't know when it was just kind of like the influence of the other two that maybe kind of rubbed off on her or something. But she really kind of brings something kind of properly chaotic to this.
Mm-hmm.
Like that kind of weird kind of like constantly kind of not paying attention to anything. But the dichotomy, you've got Mary who hangs on Winifred's every word and Sarah who's barely listening.
Yeah,
dead man's toe, dead man's toe, dead man's toe.
She's throwing herself into this role in a way that I don't think I've ever seen her do ever anywhere else. And it's really, really fun to watch. Like Wendy was looking her up and naming all these films that she was in. And I was like, oh, I forgot she was in Ed Wood. Like, I really love that movie and I forgot she was in it. But yeah, she's just incredibly fun here. Kathleen and Jimmy is always awesome, but she's incredibly fantastic in this. And Bette Midler's Bette Midler. You know, like you're never not going to at least get something entertaining out of Bette Midler.
I'd say out of the three of them, Kathy the Jimmy is possibly given the shortest shrift. Like, I feel like there's less Mary Sanderson bits compared to the other two. Mm-hmm. I feel like she may have been the victim of sort of like, you know, if stuff kind of went on the cutting room floor for time, they probably lost some of the Mary stuff. It's like she's absolutely fantastic. I just think generally in the film, Winifred and Sarah get more to do.
Though I do enjoy her occasional like dog imitations that she's doing.
And she does have like great comedy looks. You know, like things her face is doing in a lot of the kind of like when she's not speaking, just kind of in the background, her voice was fantastic. Yeah.
Like, I live for her reaction to the baby on the TV.
And the bit when Penny Marshall comes down, she's trying to mute her with the remotes.
I love when their brooms are stolen and they have to go out. And so Winnie and Sarah find like a broom and a mop in a closet. But Mary has to ride the vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. Which turns out to be her undoing later on as well. Chekhov's flying vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. And I enjoy they keep that in the sequel where she ends up with a ring. Right.
I haven't seen the sequel, so that's that. The likes be no end.
You could very safely go the rest of your life without seeing the sequel.
The novel of like Hocus Pocus 2, the novel is pretty good, but I don't know why it's so different from the movie, because it was written. They were done together, but they're really different. The book is good.
So what do we think of the kids in this? Because obviously this is kind of been like, you know, this is a kid-aimed movie and our protagonists are teenagers / tweens. So, I mean, like, yeah. I know, like, Omri Katz was kind of like, he was on the cusp of maybe being something that might happen. I think he's okay here. Obviously, you know, He will never kind of top his greatest achievement of Marshall Teller in Erie, Indiana. But, you know, yeah, I think he's fine here.
He's fine. I mean, I guess he's meant to be our protagonist, but this movie is all about the witches for me and many people. You know, but he's solid playing Max, like this fish out of water. His family's just moved from California and everybody kind of mocks him, being like, hey, California guy. He does, like, he has a believable crush on a girl, and he loves his sister and protects her, and the kids are all fine. Vanessa Shaw plays Allison, who's kind of there, like, just to be the love interest, but she turns out to be, like, a really solid person, right? She went, when they're being pursued by the witches and Danny is in danger, Danny's much younger than they are, she really protects Danny and takes a very almost motherly role in making sure that she's protected and safe and feels safe. And she's smart, like, she does research to protect him. At one point, the witches are coming, and she figures out that a salt circle will protect them, and she's the one that goes and gets the salt and uses it to keep them safe. And she's the clever one who figures out that they can probably burn the witches alive in the kiln and at the high school. But the kids are all solid. It's just the witches are so fucking iconic.
Yeah. And then you've got the two kind of bullies who are essentially Skull and Bulk from the Power Rangers. give it a fresh lick of paint.
Yeah. One of them is Larry from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suspect that the movie as delivered is much different than the script that was given to everybody, because I imagine that they had so much great stuff coming from the witches that they just sort of edited around them. Mm. That's just a theory, because as you say, the kids are fine. The kids are doing kid stuff. They are, you know, Max is sort of the ostensible lead of this movie, but he's not super interesting in any way. Omri Katz does a perfectly good job with him. He's just sort of there to kind of be the hero.
But I think the most definite thing he does to influence the action comes right at the end when he drinks the last remaining potion so they can't give it to Danny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of throws himself under the bus and makes, you know, gives them no choice but to drain him.
Like, Allison's good. Allison, as you know, Wendy, as you said, she sort of has an idea of how to kind of get through this, you know, and she does it as best she can. She's just as much in charge of the situation as Max is. And the movie, again, for a 90s kids movie, I really kind of appreciate that she kind of shows that a high school girl can be popular and also nice. Mm. You know, that is something that's possible. I'm going to give a little extra to Thora Birch, though. I think she's actually really good as Danny. She's got quite
100%.
She's got quite a lot of charisma, much more so than the other two.
Yeah, it'd be very easy for that to become an irritating character quite quickly in the hands of somebody else.
Yes. Yeah. Like,
she's only 10.
She's only 10. I mean, she's wise beyond her years, but she's also recognizably a 10-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
So sure. That is, I really think she's doing a great job. To kind of keep it going, it's always nice to see Charlie Rocket.
Yeah.
You know, I think that he does a great job as kind of a goofy dad that's only half paying attention to what's going on.
And he's really into his Dracula costume.
He's really into his Dracula costume.
Where are you supposed to be? Madonna? Isn't it obvious?
But I really like that scene, you know, in the town hall where, you know, Rocket's kind of being like, again, he's being goofy and he's dancing and he's joking around until Max tells him that something's wrong with Danny, and he instantly turns into dad.
Yeah.
You know, he instantly becomes, wait, Danny, what's wrong? What's happened? And then, of course, you know, everything's, you know, just witches. Oh, okay, I get it. All right, never mind. Okay, we're back to me dancing. So,
yeah. On the town hall scene, like, apparently they wanted to have, you know, big costumes for everyone, but it was like, we don't have the budget for that. So they basically just raided, like, Disney and Touchstone's, like, costume department for every costume in that mm-hmm. scene, which if you pay attention, you're like, oh, yeah, that's obviously from a Disney park. That's obviously from a Disney park.
Well, I mean, that's fine, isn't it? I mean, like, yeah, as long as people are recognizably in costume, it's not a problem.
It's a lot less of an issue in this movie than it is in most other movies we watch.
One thing I feel we haven't touched upon yet is the fact that this film has a talking cat in it.
Voiced by Jason Marsden. And,
like, weirdly, one of the more successful talking cats in cinema history. That's a weird sentence I never thought I'd say out loud, but here we are.
I mean, it looks infinitely better than Salem on Sabrina the Teenage Witch, right?
This was before that, right?
Yes. Sabrina was like 96, 97.
I mean, to be fair, they were dealing with an animatronic anyway. So, like, you know, it's... I mean, I get why they use the animatronic, because if you're doing a TV show, that's a lot cheaper than doing what I imagine was quite expensive for the time CGI work, kind of doing face replacement on a cat. But yeah, no, I mean, like, yeah, there's bits of it. I mean, like, again, quite a dark moment is when he gets run over and you think he's dead, and they actually show you a flattened cat, just so they can see, they can then show it kind of unflattening and coming back to life. But like, yeah, that's a moment.
The unflattening is a little disturbing.
Yes,
100%.
Yeah, Binks is a great character. So Binks is the Zachary Binks who had tried to save his sister from the Sanderson, which is 300 years in the past, is still around because he's an immortal and he's there helping Danny, kind of becoming their family. He's going to become their family cat, is what they think is going to happen. And he's angry at being cursed to live all of this time. He still has great regret for not being able to save his sister. And he loves being part of this family. And so maybe this is going to work. And the Dennison family will forever care for the cat. What I love is Danny assures Binks at some point, you know, I'm going to take care of you. And then my kids will take care of you. And then their kids will take care of you. And in Hocus Pocus 2, in the novel anyway, we find out that Danny grows up to be the weird aunt. She's the one who's not married and like she's not going to have kids. She's going to travel the world. And she's the weird kooky aunt because, of course, that's who Danny grew up to be.
You're going to turn me into a fat house cat, aren't you?
For the weird aunts of the world.
You know, she's kind of going through this whole thing of, you know, I'll take care of you and you'll have all the milk you can drink and, you know, whatever. And at the same time, there's kind of this undercurrent of, you know, I'm a guy, right? You know, I'm like a person under all this.
You kind of have to let that go, or it's a little weird that like Danny drifts off, like stroking him, like while he's like he's a cat, just buy that he's a cat.
And he's been a cat longer than he's been a person
until at the very end, when he's released from his curse, and he gets to go off to the afterlife with his sister, who's been waiting for him. And when she says, "Why? Why has it taken you so long to come, Zachary Binks?" And he says he had to wait 300 fucking years for a goddamn virgin to light the candle.
Salem, a town with a near lack of a Venn diagram of virgins and candles.
Hashtag back.
It's literally just two circles miles away from each other until Max shows up.
One of the things I love about the historical shot stuff, and this is the case for a lot of films during this era, is regardless of how period accurate the costumes or the accents will be, everyone still has very 90s hair.
Everybody has very 90s everything. This movie is like a 1993 time capsule.
Like the bully Ice, who has ice written into his name. And it's like, I hate you for that hair on multiple levels.
Yeah.
Yep. But traders being seen as currency.
Yeah.
Feels like a very 90s thing.
That was kind of a period of time where there were sneakers that cost like $200, but you could also still kind of get sneakers for $15. So, yeah, like that actually felt very true to the time. That if he had very nice sneakers, that at some point somebody was going to try to take them from him.
Yes.
There's no way they were the same size. That kid was like 6
Yes,
no,
I was about to say the same thing. So really, really, I assume you have the feet of a 16-year-old boy.
I also love that at some point along the way when they're hunting for children, the witches are very easily able to capture the bullies. I said the other ones. And they take them back to the cottage and they have them in like these little cages like hanging from the ceiling. They're going to drain their life essence, right? By the end of the movie, when everything is resolved and the Sanderson sisters are defeated and the Denisons are safe at home and everything is back to normal, the bullies are still kind of left in the cages. So I think we get to see them like sitting there wondering what's going to happen to them at the end of the film.
You know how I always remember the other bully's name? This is a film that came out in 1993 featuring a portly bully and a bully with long blonde hair named Jay.
Now, Ice is kind of a talker.
Yeah. No, Ice is a talker. Ice is not Silent Bob.
But this is kind of a movie where you do kind of have to let a lot of things just go. I will admit that for the first couple of years that we watched this movie, I always bothered by, why is Bette Midler singing? There is no reason for her to be singing this song that she has no reason to know. And then, of course, I just kind of had to go, you know what? It's Bette Midler singing. So just drop it. It's okay.
She heard it once earlier on and was like, I can do that better. Yeah. Yeah, there's things like, you just let logic go out the window, like literally how so much this film is centered around Max being a virgin. It's like, yeah, he's a fucking 13-year-old boy, of course.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely, of course he should be.
This film is weirdly fixated.
Like, this film has some very complicated thoughts on masculinity and virginity in men.
But like, that's the thing, is like, it's treated as not a big deal. It's like, of course I'm a virgin. I'm 15 years old or whatever. Like, he doesn't, like, pretend that he's not.
Like, there's no weird scene where he has to talk about his girlfriend in Canada.
Yeah.
You don't know her, man.
Yeah. She didn't show us to another school.
I'm still reading from the fact that, like there's a zombie spitting out moths and people flying around on vacuum cleaners and Dan's sitting there going, oh, this all makes perfect sense, but why is Bette Midler singing?
Welcome to my life.
Oh, I'm sorry that you found parking in the South End.
That is the most unrealistic thing in the movie, Ted.
The talking teddy bear you're okay with.
No problem with the talking teddy bear. You can't just pull into a parking space in the South End. It doesn't exist.
This is like me whenever I watch Skyfall and the bit in the London Underground where they're sliding down the bit in between the escalators. I know you can't do that. There's little signs up half on the escalators that deliberately stop you from doing that. Because if anybody's been on an escalator on the London Underground, they've thought, if those signs weren't there, I would slide down that in an instant.
Yeah, sometimes you just have to say, what the hell? But ultimately, what I like about this movie is it's really just kind of a more modern version of My Mother, the Shopping Cart. Right. It's just a lighthearted kids fantasy movie. Just like the ones that they pumped out throughout the 60s and 70s. It's just got a bit of a gloss on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, this isn't even like the darkest Disney film I've watched in the last few years. Hell, I watched Watcher in the Woods last night, and which, Jesus Christ, that one.
Yeah. Did they do something wicked that's like come?
Yeah.
Which is on Disney Plus right now and hasn't been for ages. So check that out, people. That's a dark movie.
But yeah, like, this is spooky enough to definitely be like a must watch on Halloween if you're into it. But it's also kind of lighthearted and entertaining enough that it's almost kind of like a Halloween appetizer. Like, yeah, it's the hors d'oeuvre before you go into kind of like a darker Halloween films.
It's amusing.
I mean, ultimately, it's just dark enough to have real stakes for the kids, while at the same time having multiple scenes of you know, three witches doing the monkey's walk down downtown Salem.
Like, the other one that really pops the mind is Ernest Scared Stupid.
That's actually a pretty good comparison.
The one thing I have to also bring up, like, this is something I zeroed in since I, in, like, the last few years. So, Alice's family, when we first see them at, like, Halloween, they're, you know, they're the rich people who are having, you know, their big fancy party where everyone's wearing, like, Victorian outfits with masks. And all, and I can think of only two things that are going to happen later on. One, it's going to turn into Eyes Wide Shut, or two, Allison got them out there just in time because the shunting's about to happen.
Allison's house is a real historical home in downtown Salem that you can take a tour of, and it has a beautiful garden in the backyard that anybody can just walk in and walk through. It's absolutely stunning.
I can't remember. I want to say the interior is used also for some other movie, but I can't remember which one it is.
Almost certainly, because that's a huge set.
Actually, I would like to kind of point out that the location shooting at Salem really is gorgeous. Like, they took excellent advantage of the city.
They did. So, Allison's house. Is a real, it's a, again, it's a historical mansion owned by the local museum who owns a bunch of historical in Salem. Max and Danny's house is a real house down on the waterfront in Salem. When Max goes off on his bike ride, he's mostly through Marblehead, which is the next town over. The school, the exterior of the school and the school down on Salem Common. The town hall is the historical town hall in downtown Salem. You can go and take a picture on the steps. It's tiny inside. The inside is shot on the soundstage someplace else. The cemeteries are historical cemeteries in Marblehead. And people come and do Hocus Pocus tours, and they just visit all of the sites. Like, they really took advantage. They did some stuff. They did a lot of stuff like soundstages here in New England, like most of the interiors, but they really used a lot of actual Salem and the next town over, which is just as historical and pretty, but a lot easier to close roads on.
Yeah, I mean, Salem, again, the parts of Salem that are gorgeous are gorgeous. They've shown a spotlight on a town that has turned it into its own little cottage industry, which is really nice.
I think Hocus Pocus fandom is actually what's helped turn Salem into this big Halloween destination. And it wasn't a thing. Until relatively recently, maybe the last 25 years, that, you know, Salem has always been a historic New England town and has the connection to the Salem witch trials. I think everybody who's, gone to school in the States knows about Salem witch trials. In New England, like, it's just known as, like, a beautiful town. It has this very detailed, very, very rich history for its role in the shipping trade in the 18th century. At one point, it was the wealthiest city in the entire, in the country, when the country was very small, because it had, trade, ships sailed out of Salem, to China, and they were very involved, in the opium trade. There's a whole thing about it in the PBD Essex Museum, talking about the role of local merchants in the opium wars. But Salem was a very well-known city at the time. Now it's like a little sleepy, quaint New England town. Like, you can pop in May and stay at a bed and breakfast, and it's just beautiful. You can go out on a historic schooner if you want and eat seafood in a, you know, an old 19th century building. Or you can come in Halloween in your favorite costume and go to the Halloween Museum or the Spirit Board Museum or the Pirate Museum for some reason. Or, you know, the Witch Dungeon, the Witch Museum, go to the Witch House, go to Count Orlok's Nightmare Gallery, which is an amazing museum of, like, monster movies, right? There's all these things to do. Go to the magic store, go to the magic parlor, go to the coven, get your magical supplies, go to House Witch. There's all this industry built around this tourism. And I think it's Hocus Pocus fandom that started bringing the people, and has fueled this industry that brings, it's a lot of drain on the town for their size, relative to the number of tourists that come in October. But it brings a lot of money into the city as well. Mm.
I can say just from experience that, like, before Hocus Pocus, especially before it took off, Salem during Halloween was always really fun and really nuts. But it wasn't the entire month of October. It wasn't like an entire cottage industry. like they didn't have this overall blanket of we're the witch town year round that they have now. Considering especially, and I'll die on this hill, that the witch trials did not happen in Salem.
There's a whole thing about that. Salem Village and Salem Town were two totally different things. Modern day Salem was Salem Town. That's not where all the action was. The action was happening in Salem Village, which eventually sort of died off and is now part of the town of Danvers. There's very little actual historical stuff related to that whole panic in the actual city of Salem. There's, Danny, that restaurant that we went to, the secret restaurant Turner's at Lyceum Hall. Mm-hmm. It's not the building, obviously. That building is, that's a modern 19th century building. But yeah. It's built on the site of Bridget Bishop's pub. Mm-hmm. And Proctor's Ledge is in Salem today. Proctor's Ledge is where a lot of historical and archaeological research is kind of located as the actual site where the people who were hanged. And that's in a residential neighborhood in Salem behind the Walgreens. Like, if you can find it, there's this little memorial there, but it's surrounded by houses. That's in Salem, but most of the people that were accused and the things that were happening were not happening in the actual modern-day town of Salem.
But that like encapsulates, American history, on this spot in this drugstore parking lot.
I love when tourists come to Salem and they go to the local cemetery and they think that they've been someplace because there's a memorial there to the people that lost their lives in the witch trials. But that's not where anything happened. That's a memorial for the poor. The actual place where things happened is in a residential neighborhood behind a Walgreens, and actually it would be kind of great if you didn't go there.
Soundtrack's never been released, so that's criminal.
Really? That surprises me.
You can not get a recording of Bette Midler singing a post spell on you.
He's shy. Misunderstood.
What do you do? I'm a vampire.
Have you ever seen one of these before?
18th century, right?
And he hasn't scored in 400 years.
Man, that dude sure got the blues.
He just met the perfect girl. And lost her for the 14th lifetime in a row.
Just forget the fact that we are the oldest living virgins walking the planet.
But all that is about to change.
You always die on Halloween night of your 22nd year.
Because if the devil sold his soul, he still couldn't rock and roll.
I don't think I'm a vampire. I really am a vampire.
Like Rockula.
Rockula down, devoted to sound. My name is Rockula.
Tonight's the night to keep a date with fate.
I think maybe you just need some therapy, Ralph.
And it's their one last chance.
I love you. You love me. If you don't listen to me, you're gonna die.
For romance.
I thought he was kind of cute.
I'm back!
Yo, check this out. Check this out. Check this out.
Rockula. The love story that rocks like a bat out of hell. Rockula.
Does anybody go bowling anymore?
Gee, Mr. Rockula, you're awfully good.
All right, so next up, we continued with Rockula. Dave, can you walk us through Rockula?
I certainly can. Rockula is the heartwarming tale of Ralph, who is a bad vampire. Not because he's evil, because he's not very good at it, by his own admission. He spends a lot of his time talking to his own reflection, which apparently lives a completely separate life of its own, and is capable of independent thought. And he has been cursed because the woman of his dreams, Mona, was killed by a pirate with a rhinestone peg leg and killed her with a ham bone. And every 22 years, Mona is reincarnated and is once again killed by a rhinestone-legged pirate with a ham bone. And Ralph has unsuccessfully prevented this from happening, like, multiple times. And this time round, he's like, you know what? I'm out. I'm not doing this again. It always goes the same way. I'm not even going to go meet her. He then proceeds to pull what is known as the George McFly and get hit by a car that's driven by Mona. So they end up meeting. Mona is in a band, which is led by Stanley, a very effete British man who runs a weird home shopping network channel as well. Ralph kind of has a change of heart and decides that he is going to try and save her this time. And to get her attention, because like he's kind of, when they've been talking awkwardly in the past, he said he's in a band, which he isn't. He forms a band with his friends and they end up calling themselves Rockula and get quite successful. All while this is happening, it turns out that Ralph's mother, who is Phoebe, has actually been arranging for Mona to be killed multiple times by different people dressed as a rhinestone peg-legged pirate with a ham bone. Because she doesn't believe her boy is ready to kind of grow up and leave the nest. But this time round, Ralph kind of stands up for himself. Phoebe realizes the error of her ways and Mona is saved. And Stanley is cryogenically frozen and forced to listen to his own motivational tapes. And then Stanley's reflection breaks through the mirror and becomes Elvis.
So I think that kind of scratches the surface of this movie.
A little.
Okay, first of all, has anybody seen this before other than myself?
No, this is my first time.
Nope.
No.
I didn't think that I had seen it, but once we saw the Bat Dork, I know that I had seen it.
Okay.
Possibly not all the way through.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Dave, you walked us through it. Can you tell me what you were thinking during Rockula?
I was weirdly charmed by this. It's actually kind of sweet when you get down to it. The guy playing Ralph is like a pretty kind of charming actor playing sort of someone who's a bit ineffectual and sort of a bit weak-willed and sort of finding himself. And certainly kind of finding himself through music and sort of through forming the band Rockula that he kind of gains a bit of confidence in himself. Thomas Dolby as Stanley is hilarious. He's he's an absolute riot in this. And the different adverts for his home shopping network, particularly the ones for his series of graveyard equipment, are really funny. Like the rotisserie coffin for when you want people who disapprove of you to literally turn in their graves. is genius. I mean, the songs were a bit meh. I kind of tuned out during a lot of them while they were going on. But the rest of it, yes, it's chaos. And, you know, Tony Basil is in this just being bonkers. But yeah, I ended up having a lot of fun with it. And like, I'd watch this again.
Okay, cool. Will, how about yourself?
This was absolutely a nutso film. Like literally looking at the poster, nothing could have prepared me for how like bizarre it gets. Like the poster is literally just, oh, he's a vampire and he has a guitar and here's his fangs and there's a guy with a cross and there's, you know, the love interest. And that's like, okay, there, I've seen this poster like a million times while I'm just scrolling through movies to watch on whatever streaming service. And always it's like, I'm going to keep scrolling. Like, this is just peak 80s. Yeah, I'm just going to scroll past it. And actually sitting down and watching it, it's like just such a weird film. Like, there's just so many of these weird non sequiturs in it, like just randomly happening. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is beautiful. Like, I'm not going to say it's art, but it's, you know, it wouldn't be hung in the Louvre, but it would be hung in, you know, somebody's Louvre. Like, it's just, there's just so many times during it, I'm like, okay, I think the film's finally getting, oh my God, we're just going to have, like, and now there's a rapping vampire in a leotard. Got it. Okay, cool. Well, it's gonna even, oh my God, now Tony Basil is, you know, singing while her, like, fucking smokestack of a boyfriend is, like, just so into it. And oh my God, seriously, like that guy.
So do we need to give you a minute? Is that?
I'm a simple man. Okay. If you look like that, call me. If you look like Boom Boom, and
what we've discovered, Will's type. Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. It was honestly just a very fun movie, like a lot more wholesome than I was expecting because, you know, once again, it's an 80s comedy involving, you know, here's our theme for the week. Our theme for the week is the weird things virgins do.
Yeah, it is.
And yeah, it's still, like, despite the film centering on a young man's virginity for no good reason, it's still, like, just very wholesome.
I will say there is altogether too many white people rapping in this film.
It's painful. It's painful, and for some reason, Bo Diddley is there.
In spandex.
Well, you know, I'm assuming the paycheck was the right size.
And Bo Diddley and Spandex just kind of standing there doing nothing, because while he is a, what, guitar legend, he has no place in Rapula. And that song is absolutely, parents just don't understand, rewritten. Like, I was waiting for him to talk about going to live with his auntie and uncle in Bel Air.
Yeah,
I'm the vampire.
There is, like, a consistency to white people rapping in the 80s, which is very much like, we only know one rhythm to do it in, and it's terrible.
It's still not as embarrassing as the white boy rapping in Teen Witch, though. Now, the white girl rapping in Teen Witch is excellent, but that's beside the point.
So, I found out this movie existed a while back. I don't know why we were talking about Tony Basil. But I kind of Googled her. I'm like, oh, she's in this movie. Oh, it sounds bonkers. Oh my God, I want to see this. And then Danny, you went and saw it without me. And I was very, very salty about that. So I'm super glad that we finally got to see it. It was exactly as Cuckoo Banana Pants as I thought it would be. Because even though it has, like, Dean Cameron in the lead, and it seems like it's going to be about this, like nerdy vampire, kind of like figuring shit out, like, is he a rock star? Is he gonna get the girl? Is he just not gonna sit this one out because his heart's broken from all these years of losing his one true love to a maniac pirate with a jeweled peg leg and a ham bone? The mother is Tony fucking Basil, like, respect, right? She's incredible. She is gorgeous. She's beautiful. She still looks like that, and she's in her 80s. But she is beautiful. She is absolutely playing into her type. She's got these wacky, like, 40s-inspired outfits that are just bananas. She sings. She dances. At one point, she's dancing at, I think, the club. But she's got a dance partner with her who is clearly, I can't tell, because all the images are bad, but I'm pretty sure he's one of the original members of The Lockers, which is the dance troupe that she was also involved in.
Oh.
Kind of popular, like, popularizing what would eventually merge with Lock, and become, like, Pop and Lock, which is, like, a style of American hip-hop dancing. Like, she's a fucking she's there at the inception. Cause she's Tony fucking Bobby. She's incredible in this. Thomas Dolby is amazing. But, you know, if the poster, movie poster doesn't tell you this movie is going to be a complete, it's not a shit show. Like, it's like a wild fucking ride. The fact that Susan Tyrell is in it should tell you that this movie is going to be a wild fucking ride. She's incredible. She's the bartender at the bar where our vampire Ralph hangs out, right? And at the bar, like, the bar has two patrons, Ralph and his buddy, and then Bo Diddley is always there playing, like, guitar, and so they kind of become his band when he takes on this Rockula persona. And Susan Tyrell just goes for it. Like, in the first time the band plays, she's there in this bodysuit with, like, things painted on it, like, wailing on the bongos and singing backup, because she can sing, right? We know this because we've seen her sing The Witch's Egg. But she is just, this movie is everything a movie with Susan Tyrell in it should be. and it's just, it's so much, so fucking much fun. Like, this is, Jane Cameron is absolutely playing, like, the kind of role he would have played, like, through the, what is this, the 80s or the early 90s? Like, this is absolutely, like, the kind of role that you would expect him to play before he kind of turned into a, whatever he is now. Super libertarian guy. But he is so good in this role, which is so ridiculous. Playing the rock star who only sings songs about himself, like all famous rock stars do. Or the white rapper who only raps about himself, like all Vanilla Ices do. It's wild. And, like, props to Susan Tyrell, props to Tony Basil, Thomas Dolby, fantastic in it. This was a lot of fun. I'm so glad that we picked this for a Halloween movie.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Wendy. Yeah. I mean, I did watch this before. Sorry, Wendy. I think you were just not home and it came up. But this movie is absolutely bugfuck nuts. But also, it's not self-consciously so. It's like organically bugfuck nuts, right? It's like written in a way that has absolutely very little regard for plot or logic, but it's also like not self-conscious about it. It just happens to be like that. It's a movie, it's an 80s, it was released in 1990, but it was, I guess, filmed in 88. It's an 80s romantic comedy starring a very run-of-the-mill 80s romantic comedy lead. But it's also the kind of movie where every 5 to 10 minutes you just look at it and go, wait, what? And it is, like Dave said, it's just charming. It's just, like, Ralph is so likable in this movie. You know, he's just a guy. The fact that he is a vampire barely plays into this movie at all. You know, he sings songs about being a vampire. And a couple of times he turns into Bat Dork, which we'll definitely have to get into. But other than that, he's just a guy. Like, he doesn't drink blood. He doesn't attack people. He's able to go out in sunlight because he puts on SPF 100 sunblock. You know, it's just that kind of movie. This movie has a vibe. I don't remember it being there. But it has a vibe where this would have lived on Comedy Central in the pre-South Park era. Like, I can, in my head, I can hear Penn Jillette letting me know that Rockula is going to be on this Saturday at 2 p.m. Like, it's just that kind of vibe. And a lot of it has to do with just the cast. How did this cast happen? I don't understand it. Like, Bo Diddley is in this movie in like a bee costume at one point or some shit. Like, it's crazy. It's absolutely insane. Although I got to say, if you're a director and you say to your casting director, I need a weird chick to like dress up like a punk rock mutant, post-apocalyptic
just stripes and torn shit everywhere, and have her dance like a maniac while playing the bongos. And if her first words out of her mouth are not, "How about Susan Tyrell? You need a new casting director." Like, she is perfect for what's not a very big role, but she's kind of like there doing Susan Tyrell stuff throughout. Just being weird and just being in the background stealing scenes while things are happening in front. I will say, with this, she officially becomes the actor that we've talked about the most on this show. She was tied with another actor whose third movie has not been released yet, so I'm not going to get into it. Yeah. And like everybody else says, Thomas Dolby is like in another movie entirely. Like, as weird as this movie is, most of the performances are fairly grounded. Tony Basil notwithstanding. Again, we'll get into that. But Thomas Dolby is a Batman villain in this movie. Like, he is just wild. And Dave, like you said, like, you know, we see Mona's video, which at one point is like actually presented like all of a sudden we're in a musical until we find out that it's her music video. But then that's followed up directly by Thomas Dolby's mortuary advertisement that just has to be seen to be believed. Like, it's almost like just a bunch of like sketch comedy ideas that were just sort of thrown out and turned into a commercial. You know, if you miss your ex-wife and you want her to be able to nag you from beyond the grave, we have an option for you.
Also known as the Harry Mudd special.
Yes.
You know what it is? It's the good version of the random stand-up comedian in the middle of Trick or Treat.
Or, yeah, Hackle Lantern. Yeah. No. It's no reason to be there. It doesn't move the plot along. It's just all of a sudden we're doing something else for a couple of minutes. But you know what? This movie's done that 7 or 8 times at this point. So what's one more? And it's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Thomas Dolby and Tony Basil together are so funny when Phoebe's masquerading as his psychic because she's trying to get him to set him up as the pirate this time round.
Madame Benoit?
Yeah. Well, she spends all of it. Despite the fact that they've never met and have no connections, she's constantly hiding her face behind a fan and talking in sort of like a mysterious accent, sort of going for some sort of Eastern European, sort of Transylvanian sort of thing, I guess. But like, yeah. The two of them on screen together, like him being kind of roll your eyes crazy and her just being so arch, is somehow hilarious in ways that it really shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Like, in the hands of anyone else, this would be awful. And yet, for some reason, it works here.
Well, because they just go for it.
Yeah.
They just absolutely just throw themselves into it with no fear or reservation whatsoever. And it works because, like I said, everybody else, even Susan Tyrell, is just a guy. You know, they're just playing a person. And these two are basically Yosemite Sam.
Like, I have like three different times that I wrote, so-and-so deserves their own movie. It's like, Tony Basil deserves her own movie. The villain deserves his own movie. Mona's friend/keyboardist deserves her own movie.
Yeah, I mean, again, is it art? I mean, to the extent that every movie is art, but I mean, you know, no, it's not. It's just it's a canon film. Like, the first thing we see when the movie starts is the Canon logo, and it's like, okay, I get it.
Like an old hug from a friend,
right?
My first note is canon in all uppercase letters with 3 exclamation marks.
The appropriate response to the canon logo.
Yeah, this is after Galan and Globus had their falling out, so it's not a classical era canon movie. But again, you see that logo, you know what you're in for.
Just low budget wackiness. And it is that. But it's also just so likable. Like, it's just a likable movie with a lot of people in it that you kind of root for because you like them. That's a weird tightrope to pull off. And I suspect that it was accidental because you can't plan for that.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. Like, I was kind of expecting this to be a bit of a, but like, by the end of it, I was so just kind of, yeah, like, I just kind of found the central story kind of sweet, which I think kind of helps the, kind of grounds the kind of craziness that's all around it. And I think that's one of the things that kind of, I think kind of made it work for me is the fact that kind of, like, yeah, the kind of, the central romance is kind of what you'd expect from, like, any kind of 80s romantic comedy, just has the trappings of a, what, more bizarre film. And then that kind of gives it the freedom to kind of go off the rails elsewhere because you keep coming back to this kind of very nice central story.
But there's so much happening with Dean's vampirism and all that. That's just like, what? Huh? Like, again, he talks to his doppelganger in the mirror who talks back to him again, like you said, Dave, like he's just a completely sentient other entity. And that's never explained. It's never like, we don't know what's going on with that. It's just there. It's just happening.
Is this reflection having an orgy with other people's reflections?
Yes. You know, what? Okay, sure. Why not? You know, so we get a scene, you know, he's going back and forth between two funhouse mirrors. And again, they just kind of do 2 or 3 minutes on that just because why not?
Yeah, including probably one of the most unexpected but actually quite funny dick jokes that I think any film managed to pull off.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I'm just generally kind of delighted and surprised by this.
And I think it wouldn't work without Dean Cameron. I think that his performance as Ralph grounds the movie, solidifies it, and just like you don't like this movie doesn't work without him.
Agreed.
He never, like, you don't really see a lot of him anymore. You didn't really see a lot of him then either, to be honest with you. If you know who he is, it's because he was Chainsaw in Summer School, which was, when it came out, a fairly popular movie. It's kind of been lost to the mists of time since then. But yeah, he's terrific.
Mm. Yeah, and like even when sort of like the first time he turns into that weird bat creature, mm-hmm. basically, which he says, like, he's so out of practice of turning into a bat. And then what you get is this weird kind of tiny bat-human hybrid. Almost, but not quite a bat.
It's cuddly. It looks like it's like Gizmo, like from Gremlins.
Yeah.
With a bat.
And the idea that this thing at the end terrifies Stanley so much that he falls into his own cryo booth thing because he just doesn't know what to do with this image. So,
Well, I mean, Stanley's an idiot. Yeah. The Bat Dark was portrayed by the actor Tamara Dutrow, who was a little person actor. She was, I believe, at least when she worked on E.T., the shortest actor who had been working in film. She worked on E.T. She worked in some other films. And there's actually that scene where after the first performance where Rockula is going down the hallway of all the adoring fans, there is like a little person there, like in the meet and greet line, and that's her.
Oh, okay.
And I just thought that I thought it was unusual to see that casting choice. And so I looked her up like, okay, that is the Bat Dork actor.
Yeah.
who was also did some specialized work as ET.
I think the director also directed directed Ghoulies, which she's also in.
I can say the first time I saw the Bat Dork, I genuinely had to pause the movie. Because I could not stop laughing. I mean, it's hideous, but it's also adorable.
Yeah.
No, it's so cute, though. Like, yeah. I would totally buy a plushie of that.
Yeah. And it's just sitting there in like Ralph's polka dot underwear.
Mm. Yeah, well, it manages to be adorable, but at the same time, you're going, what the fuck am I looking at?
And that's kind of this movie in a nutshell.
Fair point. Yeah, I can't argue with that.
But, oh my God, Tony Basil is amazing. Just absolutely fucking incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Just, again, so fucking camp. And having a great time.
Mm.
And it's one of those things where it's like, easy to forget, like when they filmed this, she was only a few years off of Mickey. So,
well, this is pre-Mickey.
No, this is a little bit after Mickey, but not much after Mickey.
But she's been working since the 60s.
Yeah. And like you said, Wendy, you said to me anyway, like this is the second time we've encountered Tony Basil on this podcast. Because she was she was Davey's dance partner and head.
Oh yes, of course she was. Yeah,
she's the choreographer.
Mm-hmm. But oh my God, she's just having a great time in that dance she does.
Oh, she's so good.
Yeah,
the dance she does in the living room for Ralph and Mona is just gotta be, like you said to me, Wendy, like it's gotta be the reason that she agreed to be in the movie.
Because they let her sing. And she sings the whole song.
Yeah.
Not just like a little bit of the song. She sings the whole fucking song.
Yeah. When Tony Basil is dancing after 90 seconds, Wendy is like, okay, I think we've had enough of this song. Then you've got too much song.
Although I think it's beautifully undercut by the extremely awkward silence between Mona and Ralph straight afterwards.
That was hilarious.
Like, they both just look utterly shell-shocked by whatever the hell that just was.
That look on Mona's face is like the best thing she does in the entire movie. Not that there's anything wrong with her. Tawny Foray does a perfectly serviceable job as the pretty girl that the lead's in love with.
Mm.
There's not much to that role.
Which,
and she,
yeah, you need that in one of these films, but
yeah,
it's a thankless job.
It absolutely is. I will say, when we see her, when she performs her first number in front of the crowd, I actually did think to myself, wow, this might be a pretty nice song if someone else were singing it.
Yeah, you're not alone there. No.
Yeah.
She went to the Rex Harrison School.
She's a dancer. Who can sing?
Yeah. Hilariously, both she and Tony Basil were in the third Angel film, which is the one that Susan Terrell is in.
Yeah. Angel 3. I've watched, for my sins, I have watched all three Angel movies. I don't count the fourth one. Angel 3.
I forgot there was a fourth one.
Angel 3.
Is that an Angel in Space or something?
Pretty much. It was direct to Showtime, I think.
Right.
Angel 3 has a scene where, you know, the whole point is, like, you know, Angel's grown up. She's left that life behind her. She's, you know, moving forward. I think, I don't remember what her job is. Like, she's a lawyer or an investigative reporter or something, but it involves investigating some kind of criminal ring. And she, you know, goes to the warehouse where the big
ending battle is about to go down, and they're smuggling whatever it is they're smuggling, whether it be drugs or guns or whatever. It doesn't matter. And she looks at it, and she's like hiding and kind of looking down on it. And she says, I have to do something about this. And she goes off and changes to Angel to take down this criminal enterprise. It's just like Angel 3 is basically, she's basically Batman. Where Angel is her vigilante.
Excellent.
Identity.
Angel. Angel.
I'm good with this.
Like, oh God, the Angel movies are batshit. Like, the first one was the normal one. It gives you any indication. But anyway. Oh, yeah. Other than, as you say, I think, yeah, Dave, I think it was you that said that the music is there. It's fine. It's unremarkable. Yeah. But it's basically okay for the most part. I'm surprised it took us until the very last song before Bo Diddley actually played the Bo Diddley riff.
his price for doing more than one is probably exorbitant.
Yeah. But again, the scene where the, you know, Ralph is kind of lamenting his lot in life and doesn't know, like what he, that leads to him deciding to start a rock band, where he's just kind of noodling on the piano.
Hmm.
And Axeman is playing along with, like, playing off him, was pretty good. Ooh. I thought that, like, that felt very natural, and I really liked it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole kind of, like, the band between them have, like, a weird, like, that kind of montage where they're trying out different looks and music styles, where, you know, at one point you get to see Bo Diddley dressed as a mariachi. Like, yeah, that's a thing. Yeah. But, like, yeah, it does kind of give off this, like, this is a bunch of friends who have come together to try and start a band, and, you know, they're just trying to, like, messing around and trying to find what their hook and what their thing is. And it's actually, again, we keep coming back to it, quite charming.
Yeah. The first thing we see is, you know, they're dressed up as kind of a Dixieland band sort of situation. And I think Wendy was even like, oh, no, they're going to go there.
Like, as we've been talking this out, I just realized what this is a riff on. There's almost no way this author had not at least, you know, heard of the sequel to Interview with the Vampire, the Vampire Lestat, which in which Lestat is a rock star.
Yes,
I want that in season 3 of Interview with the Vampire to see Lestat rapping.
Isn't there like a TV movie or something they're doing with the vampire stuff?
Yeah.
They're doing some sort of spin-off, aren't they?
Yeah, the TV series Interview with a Vampire, the first 2 seasons were like a reimagining of Interview, and the third season, which they just released the trailer for, is starting with the novel The Vampire Lestat.
Ah.
Correction, a vampire with a complicated history with his mom.
Is Rockula a secret underground Anne Rice adaptation?
I mean, it is now.
This is the expose you only hear on this podcast.
Hard-hitting news. Oh, man. He's the DJ, I'm the vampire.
Wait, did I say that?
No, that's the name of that. That's what he sings. That's an actual line in the song.
This was like, this is a little early, like Will Smith. Like, oh, he's directly referencing what he's doing.
Yeah, this is, again, I remember watching it before and thinking that it was really fun and wow, what a cast. But I forgot how much fun this movie is.
Ooh.
And it's like nobody's ever heard of it, but it's so fun.
Okay, well, thank you everybody for being here and celebrating Halloween with us. This was really fun. Please, especially now, take care of yourself, drink some water, and go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. I bear no responsibility for what's about to happen.
Yo, homes, what's up? Oh, not much, you know, I've just been hanging with Yolanda and Dee. Kick it!
Whoa.
How's that?
Whoa, that's some kick.
Thank you.
Jeez, what a weird guy.
There was this girl named Mina. She wanted Melina. She was singing back and forth, Ike and Tina. I liked her bangs. She liked my fangs. So we decided to do the crazy Dracula thing. Now her father didn't like it, so he called me a pig. I said, Dr. Van Helsing, here's something you'll dig. We can sing Kumbaya around the campfire.
Are you the DJ?
No, I'm the vampire. I said I'm the vampire.